Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Classic English Literature Podcast. This is where rhyme gets its reason. Today, we return to our discussion of Edmund Spenser, Elizabethan poet, bureaucrat, and swotty tryhard. Last time around, we looked at Spenser's more important lyric poetry, especially the pastoral Shepherd's Calendar, the sonnet cycle Amoretti, and that cycle's sort of concluding poem, Epithalamion. You might remember that in the Shepherd's Calendar, the shepherd Piers advised his friend to give up pastoral poetry and try his lanolin soft hand at epic. Quote, "Sing of bloody Mars, of wars, of jousts." Well, here's Spenser following his own advice. This time, we're going questing in the Faerie Queen, his great allegorical epic, in which the speaker declares, quote, "I of wars and bloody Mars do sing." But before we saddle up with the knights, ladies, and monsters of Spenser's Magnet Octopus, let me once again tell you that my email is classicenglishliterature, that's all one word, classicenglishliterature@gmail.com. Feel free to drop me a line. I would love to hear from you. The podcast also maintains a presence on the hippest social media platforms, including YouTube nowadays, so follow me on those. A 5-star review on your podcast app would make me weep with gratitude, and a small financial donation would make me positively wail in appreciation. Thank you for supporting our little chats. And speaking of support, I would like to thank listener Magnus for the very thoughtful and kind email. I am really, really glad to hear from you, Magnus, and I love your ideas. And another deep thank you to listener Roland for your very generous contribution to the show. Really, wow. You have my deepest gratitude. Thank you so much for listening and helping.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, The Faerie Queen is an imposing work. It's over 36,000 lines in over 4,000 stanzas. One website estimates that it would take an average reader some 21 hours to tackle. So I imagine you've all read it through a couple of times in preparation for today's discussion. Please do not undeceive me. Any summary of the epic will tell you that The Faerie Queen is a work of allegorical romance concerning King Arthur in praise of Queen Elizabeth I. And insofar as a 12-word synopsis can comprehend a poem of 312,000 words, this is true. Now, obviously, there's no way of dealing with such a vast text in an episodic survey of English literature. So I'm going to be focusing primarily on the first of the poem's 6 books, the most famous, and the one most likely to be referenced at those fashionable vin et fromage parties you all attend with enviable regularity. Generally, each of the 6 books concerns the adventures of a particular knight who embodies a particular virtue. The knight faces challenges appropriate to revealing and strengthening that virtue. So, Sir Guyon of Book 2 represents temperance, and so is tempted by bliss and riches. And Sir Artegal of Book 5 is justice, and thus battles against tyranny. So as you can see, the epic operates on a highly allegorical level, just like previous medieval texts such as The Owl and the Nightingale, Piers Plowman, and Everyman. But as we saw with his lyrical poetry, Spenser is something of an ambivalent traditionalist, not content with simply, amplifying established genres. He uses the literary inheritance to extend and modernize English poetry. So, for example, while this is nominally a work of Arthurian legend, we don't see the well-rehearsed tales from Geoffrey of Monmouth or Sir Thomas Malory. Indeed, Arthur is quite scant of his royal presence, appearing only occasionally to really wow the crowd. Perhaps I should note that we are in a historical period in which Arthur and his knights have receded a bit in the cultural imagination. Spencer's is really the only major work concerning Arthur, and, as I say, quite tangentially at that. Between Malory's Mort in the 1400s and then the 19th century medieval revival with poets like Alfred Lord Tennyson. Spencer does make a point of stressing Arthur's Welsh roots, de rigueur, during the Tudor period, a family who hailed from the land of song and castles. But his real purpose is not to reassert Arthur as the primary British cultural hero so much as to, as he says in a letter to Sir Walter Raleigh, quote, "The general end, therefore, of all the book is to fashion a gentleman or noble person in virtuous and gentle discipline." Sidney's defense of poetry ring any bells here, kids? It should be clanging like Judy Garland's trolley. Yes, we are still early in the English Protestant hegemony, and there's a great deal of hand-wringing about the value of poetry. Some rather Platonic Protestants fear that poetry is deceitful, its images and symbols hiding the plain truth. This is rather ill-disguised anti-Catholicism, suspicious of a religion that deals with ritual, myth, and symbolism. Protestant reformer and biblical translator William Tyndale coined the pun popetry, something of a portmanteau of the words puppetry and popery, to denote the duplicity of Rome and its exploitation of multivalent meaning. Spencer, like Sidney, asserts that poetry can in fact effectively teach virtue, that its primary purpose is the moral perfection of humankind. And so he takes the English Catholic allegorical tradition, enunciated by the likes of William Caxton and Sir Thomas More, and redeploys it in a Protestant and humanistic endeavor. Now, the other thing we should note is Spencer's continual melding of the medieval and modern sensibilities of poetic language, form, and versification. You'll note a good deal of Anglo-Saxon-style alliteration in the poem, for example. Now, in the last episode, I noted that he consciously employed an artificially archaic form of English to establish a genuine homegrown tradition fit to rival the classical languages and their Romance offshoots. I overstated his preference for an older English. I think I implied that he kind of spurned non-English diction, and that's certainly not true. Now, there have been, from time to time, movements to purge the language of its non-Germanic influences, but Spencer wasn't part of them. He wasn't looking for a purely Anglo-Saxon English. Rather, he preferred the language as Chaucer and other Middle English writers used it. So, you know, Latinate words, for example, were totally copacetic in that milieu. And so in The Faerie Queene, too. But Spencer raises the ante a bit. The stanza form he chooses has come to be known as the Spenserian stanza. It's 9 lines long. The first 8 are iambic pentameter, the 9th iambic hexameter, 6-foot line, and it's called an Alexandrine. The 8 lines present a formal unity of thought or effect or action, and then the 9th line caps that thought or expands it. The rhyme scheme AB, ABB, CB, CC essentially presents us with 2 alternately and interlocking rhyming quatrains with an extra line and an extra foot, which doubles as a couplet too. Note that there are then 2 A rhymes, 3 C rhymes, and 4 B rhymes. This puts an extraordinary amount of pressure on a poet to inventively manipulate diction, especially since English, unlike, say, the Romance languages, is comparatively rhyme poor. We have a fairly limited pool of rhyming words when stacked against other tongues. So Spencer's use of an archaic, pseudo-Chaucerian English, reintroducing Middle English noun declensions and verb conjugations, does a good deal to expand the language's resources. And this is necessary if you've planned out 36,000 lines. So not only does he accomplish a wondrous poetic feat, pun very much intended, he simultaneously asserts the vast elastic possibilities of English, promoting it as a vehicle for cultural ascendancy and moral edification. Book 1, The Legend of the Red Cross Knight, is as good a place to start an exploration of the poem as any. It's a quest story. Hero must slay monster to rescue kingdom. And it's written in 12 sections called cantos. Comes from the Latin cantus, which means singing, so a canto is a song. It's the same root that gives us chant and enchant, by the way. Our hero is Red Cross, so called because, quote, on his breast a bloody cross he bore, and he represents the virtue of holiness. He's a young knight, new to his calling, though his armor has been worn by many before him. The beautiful maiden Una accompanies him. She has begged this quest of him to slay a dragon that imprisons her parents and their kingdom. Tagging along as well, we have a quite prudent dwarf, a loyal dog's body, who mainly frets and runs away. He does offer a helpful recap of events at one point, though. The companions lose their way in a storm and come upon a cave wherein the monster Error dwells. Red Cross defeats the beast, and continuing their travels, they come upon the hermitage where lives the evil sorcerer Akimago. As the travelers sleep, the wizard conjures a dream from the god Morpheus, a sex dream about Yuna that disgusts the blue-nosed Red Cross. The wizard also summons a look-alike for Yuna, a woman named Duessa. Subscribing to the adolescent male adage that it's disgusting when you do it, but it's awesome when this hot chick does it to me, Red Cross succumbs to Duessa's carnal temptations and desists from his quest, thus separating the knight from his maiden. During the separation, Red Cross fights Sarrazin, that is, pagan or Muslim, probably, knights. He and Duessa arrive at the House of Pride, where Mistress Lucifera arranges for a tourney between Red Cross and the knight Sans Foy, the prize being Duessa and Sans Foy's shield. You can guess who wins, since I told you this was a long story. Meanwhile, Yuna, in search of her knight, barely escapes rape by Sans Loy, another scoundrel pagan. She is rescued by Prince Arthur himself. The king-in-waiting also manages to put a giant named Orgoglio out of her misery and reveals Duessa as a hideous witch. Red Cross, however, freed from the giant, meets the monster Despair, who nearly convinces our hero to kill himself. He doesn't, of course. Long story, yeah. But he's in terrible shape. Yuna, Arthur, and the dwarf discover the ravaged youth and bring him to the House of Holiness to treat his wounds. Dame Caelia and her daughters Fidelia, Speranza, and Carissa nurse him to health, and a hermit named Contemplation reveals Red Cross's true lineage and true name. Quote, thou, St. George, shalt call it be, St. George of Merry England, the sign of victory. Well, clever listeners will suss out the ending of our tale with that little revelation. If Red Cross is actually St. George, then that great big dragon is dead, and the kingdom is freed. Una and George will marry, and England will go on to build the world's largest empire, defeat fascism, and win the 1966 World Cup. And you'd have sussed rightly, clever listener. Well done. Now, if we just left it at that, we'd have a pretty boilerplate fantasy romance. What we have instead is pretty boilerplate allegory. I exaggerate for snarky effect, but allegory does get to be a somewhat stale genre, don't you think? This actually means that, and they personify this other thing, wah, wah, wah. But before I can talk about some other interesting things Spencer has going on, we do have to get the whole extended metaphor thing sorted. So, Red Cross is Christian holiness, and Yuna is truth. The monster Error is error, false teaching, false belief. Archimago translates as arch-image, great illusion. He's a deceiver who beguiles the senses. Duessa is the opposite of Una, right? Una means one, there's only one truth, and Duessa kind of means two, or doubleness, more deception stuff. She has a great line in Canto 5, quote, "I that do seem not I." That's brilliant, I love that. It anticipates Iago's "I am not what I am" from Shakespeare's Othello. The House of Pride, like the biblical Tower of Babel, is a metaphor for human hubris, but it too is an illusion. Quote, "Stately palace built on squared brick, which cunningly was without mortar laid, whose walls were high, but nothing strong nor thick, and golden foil all over them displayed, that purest sky with brightness they dismayed. It was a goodly heap for to behold, and spake the praises of the workman's wit. But full great pity that so fair a mold did on so weak foundation ever sit. For on a sandy hill that still did flit and fall away, it mounted was full high, that every breath of heaven shaked it, and all the hinder parts that few could spy were ruinous and old, but painted cunningly." Looks beautiful, but it's a facade. Potemkin. It rests on weak foundations. Lucifera, the lady of the house, obviously recalls Lucifer, the chief angel whose hubris impelled him to rebel against God. Lucifera's train is led by six counselors named Idleness, Gluttony, Lechery, Avarice, Envy, and Wrath, right? The six deadly sins in service to pride, the greatest deadly sin, according to Christian moral theology. The House of Pride is paralleled by the House of Holiness at the book's end. Dame Caelia, whose name means heavenly. Her daughters are the three Christian virtues, faith, Fidelia, hope, Speranza, and charity, Carissa. Attending them are seven bead men, men of prayer, whose duties, such as almsgiving, comforting the sick and imprisoned, caring for widows and orphans, contrast the sins of the previous palace. They are works of mercy. There's the river in Canto 7, in which Red Cross and Duessa share that cheeky skinny dip. But when the foolish knight drinks of the water, quote, "Eftsoons his manly forces gan to fail, and mighty strong was turned to feeble frail." So the lad's strength is restored by a well in Canto 11, which, quote, "could recure an aged long decay, renew as one that were born that very day." So, we've a parallel between the enervating river and the energizing fountain. And also, he's repeatedly competing for shields. What else? Despair is despair, giving up of hope, the unforgivable sin. Sans foi is French for faithless, his brother sans loi is lawless. Now, I didn't mention the third stooge, sans joy, but you know, joyless. And of course, the dragon is Satan, the great deceiver, the serpent that tempted Adam and Eve and corrupted humankind. And by the by, Adam and Eve are Una's parents. And St. George is England, defeater of evil and defender of all things good and true, a true knight to the queen of fairy, Gloriana. Yes, good Queen Bess herself. Quote, "Goddess heavenly bright, mirror of grace and majesty divine, great lady of the greatest isle, whose light, like Phoebus' lamp, throughout the world doth shine." You need a little lip balm there, Ed? Lips are looking a little chapped. But some eloquent posterior kissing goes a long way, and it did earn him a life's pension of £50 a year from the Queen, a not inconsiderable sum. I've heard the nasty rumor that actually she forgot to put the paperwork through, and when reminded, told her treasurer to give the rhymester £100. But the parsimonious bureaucrat cut the figure in half. Maybe. Anyway, the main political point of this allegorizing is the validation of Tudor Protestantism over against the evils of Roman Catholicism. All of the villains of the piece are identified with the Romish Church, except for the Sans brothers, who are explicitly Muslim, but it's another false religion as far as Spencer and his contemporaries were concerned. The monster Error, quote, "half like a serpent horribly displayed, but the other half did woman's shape retain," when slain by Red Cross, quote, spewed out of her filthy maw a flood of poison horrible and black, full of great lumps of flesh and garbage raw, which stunk so wildly that it forced him slack his grasping hold, and from her turn his back. Her vomit full of books and papers was, with loathly frogs and toads which eyes did lack, and creeping sought way in the weedy grass, her filthy paw break all the place defiled has. The books and papers represent the false teachings of corrupt Catholicism, the written word. Error's loathsome offspring are black as ink, to emphasize the point. In fact, the slain dragon's black gory blood in Canto 11 also seems likened to ink. And when we first meet Archimago, he tells of, quote, saints and popes, and evermore he strode an Ave Maria after and before. His name, of course, refers to Catholicism's use of icons, rituals, and symbols to dazzle the innocent believer. The old woman of Canto 3, quote, day and night did pray upon her beads devoutly penitent, 900 paternosters every day, and thrice 900 aves she was wont to pray. And the thief that robs churches for her, whose name is Kirk Rapine, which means church robber, he almost seems justified in a Robin Hoodie kind of way. Quote, he was to weet a stout and sturdy thief, wont to rob churches of their ornaments, and poor men's boxes of their due relief, which given was to them for good intents. The holy saints of their rich vestments he did disrobe when all men careless slept, and spoiled the priests of their habiliments, whiles none the holy things in safety kept. Then he, by cunning sleights, in at the window crept. This, the church is the real thief, conceit gets echoed by the description of Covetous in the House of Pride, who, quote, hated all good works and virtuous deeds, and him no less that any like did use, and who with gracious bread the hungry feeds, his alms for want of faith he doth accuse, so every good to bad he doth abuse. And Duessa wears at one point a, quote, gold and purple pall to wear, and triple crown set on her head full high, and her endowed with royal majesty, then for to make her dreaded more of men, and people's hearts with awful terror tie. So she's dressed, right, like a pope. So in these descriptions, Spencer chastises the Catholic Church for its worldliness, its hypocrisy, its political ambitions. Too much, he feels, has Rome ascribed its glory to its own works, its own strength. He makes his Protestant point explicit in the first stanza of Canto 10. Quote, what man is he that boasts of fleshly might and vain assurance of mortality, which all so soon as it doth come to fight against spiritual foes yields by and by, or from the field most cowardly doth fly? Now let the man ascribe it to his skill that through grace hath gained victory. If any strength we have, it is to ill, but all the good is God's, both power and eke will. That last line, actually, is a pretty good summation of the theological point of the poem, isn't it? Human effort always only comes to ill. We are powerless without grace. God only alone is good. Which leads me to a point I've been thinking about concerning the protagonist, Red Cross. On the surface, he seems a quite typical questing hero, young, brash, eager, a little cocky. He will be humbled by his trials, and finally, by discovering his humility, he discovers true strength. Yeah, it sounds like any Sunday sermon or any number of heroes from our popular culture, Luke Skywalker, Taran Wanderer, Arthur Pendragon, probably a bunch from Marvel Comics, but I wouldn't know, personally. Keep sleeping through those movies. Anyway, these are all versions of a heroic archetype popularized by mythologist Joseph Campbell, who based his interpretations on the work of psychologist Carl Jung. The hero starts as an obscure individual born under unusual circumstances in some backwater. gets called to some outlandish adventure, meets a mentor who guides him, overcomes challenges, and fulfills the quest, returning to his people a more mature person. So in this framing, heroism is a process of fashioning. One is not born a hero, one must struggle to become one. And again, on the surface, Red Cross seems to tick some of these boxes. What interests me, however, is the quirky dimension that allegory adds to this formula. Red Cross doesn't become something or someone new at the end of the book. He doesn't emerge as from a chrysalis, utterly transformed. He doesn't become holiness. He always was holiness. His story's not one of metamorphosis, like in Canto 2's episode involving Fra Dubio, who is changed into a tree. Rather, Red Cross's story is one of manifestation, or realization literally understood. Red Cross's essence is static, it's unchanging. Through his quest for Yuna and Gloriana, he becomes who he always was. So I think it makes more sense to understand a line like, quote, "So new this newborn knight to battle new did rise," when Red Cross rises again to slay the dragon, as synonymous with a line a little bit later, quote, "his late renewed might." Granted, yep, the repetitions do seem to drive the point of novelty home. But renewal seems more consistent with Red Cross's allegorical reification of holiness. It always already was. And all this seems, to me, consonant with the Neoplatonic current swirling around the poem. All right, let me back up a second. Neoplatonism is a philosophical school emerging from late antiquity, around the 3rd century CE, that sought to reconcile various philosophical and religious beliefs, including Platonism, Aristotelianism, Stoicism, and a smattering of Egyptian and Eastern mysticism. Its core concept describes a hierarchical universe with multiple levels of reality. The ultimate reality, according to Neoplatonism, is a transcendent and ineffable principle called the One, or the Good, the source of all existence. From the One emanates a series of intermediate principles, such as the intellect, which gives rise to the world's soul, sustaining the physical world, itself a reflection of higher spiritual realities. So Neoplatonism emphasizes mystical union with the divine, advocating a process of spiritual ascent where individuals seek to transcend their lower material existence and attain a direct experience of the divine through contemplation, meditation, and philosophical inquiry. So the Fairy Queen has some very strong Neoplatonic elements. Its hierarchical structure, based on a series of analogues, you know, the whole allegory thing. Yuna is the One, right? Truth with a capital T. Red Cross must transcend his lower existence to reach the divine. But transcend doesn't mean to get rid of. He must move beyond the physical and intellectual images that cloak his already pre-existing higher reality. Now, I suppose in our pop psychology world, we could call this self-actualization. But Spencer isn't copping to some mere navel-gazing. He's illuminating what he believes is the human soul's purpose in a divinely ordered chain of being. He, in a quite orthodox way, acknowledges humanity's fallen nature. Remember Adam and Eve. And he has Red Cross confess to them his failings. But this is potential renewal, transfiguration, if you want to be so bold, not transmutation. Now, at the end of what people in tweed jackets with leather elbow patches call the mutability cantos, we get confirmation of this thesis. The mutability cantos probably represent an unfinished book 7 of the Fairy Queen, and these fragments tell the tale of the Titaness Mutability, which means change or changeableness, you might recall. Think mutant or mutation. Mutability challenges Jove and all the gods, basically, for supremacy of the world. She argues that all things are subject to change. The four elements, the four seasons, the months, days, and hours, even the planets, the gods themselves. However, Mother Nature finds against her with this ruling, quote, "They are not changed from their first estate, but by their change their beings do dilate, and turning to themselves at length again, do work their own perfection so by fate. Then over them change doth not rule and reign, but they rule over change and do their states maintain." All right, I'll stop punching the bruise. Perhaps it's best to end at the beginning. The Fairy Queen is an epic, and Spencer makes sure he hits all the epic marks, right? It's a long narrative poem with serious intent, it has elevated diction, and he's very liberal with his Homeric similes. You know, those long comparisons characteristic of the Greek epics? Spencer likes to flex here. And he, of course, begins with the invocation of the muse. Here, probably Cleo, the muse of history. But he does it all weird. He makes himself the object of the invocation. He begins with, quote, "Lo, I the man whose muse whilom did mask." And then he humbly recognizes that, quote, "me all too mean the sacred muse arides." He also calls upon Queen Bess to, quote, "raise my thoughts too humble and too vile." It's his development as a man and as a poet he calls for, not necessarily for the poem itself, right? Homer wants to sing of Achilles' wrath, Virgil of arms and the man, but Spencer wants what he calls his argument vouchsafed. The proem immediately puts the individual self at the center of the poem's project. Okay, I punched a bit more. Sorry. Thanks for your time and attention, and I'll talk to you real soon.